Okay, well, I think we've got a quorum, so we're going to get started. Yeah, we're covering a very large subject today, so bear with me, and feel free to interrupt. It's a much more casual setting than anticipated, so take advantage of it. So I'll be talking today. I am Dr. Jim, renal attending. I think I know most of you. I will be talking about the two huge subjects of chronic kidney disease and dialysis. They seem to be similar as one leads to the other, but they have distinct differences. So chronic kidney disease. First, we start with the definition of chronic kidney disease. And the definition we go by is established by the National Kidney Foundation, NKF. And the Kidney Disease Outcomes Quality Initiative called DOKI. So when nephrologists talk about guidelines, they always go by the K-DOKI guidelines. And their criteria for chronic kidney disease is anybody with kidney damage for more than 3 months, with or without GFR, but as you know, most of our patients do have decreased GFR. And clinically, they are manifested either by pathologic abnormalities or markers of kidney damage, including anything wrong with the blood or urine, specifically creatinine or other markers of filtration problems or any problems in the imaging, oftentimes an ultrasound or a CAT scan. Or if a patient has a GFR of less than 60 ml per minute per 1.73 meters squared for more than 3 months. Now, beware that this GFR calculation is in terms of ml per minute, but it's per 1.73 meters squared, which is an average body surface area of a person. And in our population, I think most of our patients are actually larger than 1.73. So we're not sure where this number came from, but we have to bear in mind that this is specific for this, and if our GFR is 60 for a bigger person, they may already have met criteria for CKD with a higher GFR. What are the causes of ESRD? ESRD standing for end-stage renal disease. Of course, they usually start with CKD, leading towards ESRD. Well, this data is from the USRDS, or US Renal Data System, which is a national data system compiled back in 2006. Unfortunately, our most current report, which is already 2 years old. And it shows that diabetes comprises the highest percentage of cause of ESRD, 36.7%. But this probably does vary from region to region. Our population is probably more than 50% of end-stage renal disease caused by diabetes. Hypertension, a large percentage of 24.4%. And then it starts trickling down to glomerulonephritis, 16.1%. Cystic or congenital diseases, less than 10%. Interstitial nephritis, pyelonephritis, less than 5%. And secondary glomerulonephritides, such as SLE, vasculitis, all the things that you learn about in medical school that seems to be so important, actually only makes up 3.3% of ESRD patients. In order to assess the kidney function, we have to calculate a GFR. GFR standing for glomerular filtration rate. And the only way we can do it is to estimate the GFR. Now, we usually compare all our equations to the gold standard, which is inulin. As you recall, the best substance to represent true kidney function is a substance that is freely filtered, neither reabsorbed, nor secreted, nor metabolized, or anything else that happens to its molecular structure in the urine as it passes through the glomerular filter and the tubules. And inulin is our gold standard, but it requires, in order to measure inulin clearance, it requires a continuous IV infusion, frequent blood draws, and a bladder catheterization. So obviously we're not doing this to every one of our patients to get a GFR measurement. There are other substitutes such as iothalamates, DTPA, but these markers may be easier, but still not that practical. This is a formula that I think most of you may have memorized for the boards, and you still may need to memorize this for the boards. It's the Cockcroft-Gault formula, and it simplified our estimation of GFR by utilizing the patient's age, body weight, and serum creatinine, and the gender of the patient. So women tend to have a lower GFR than men. Unfortunately, this formula is no longer as popular because it has been shown to overestimate true GFR. So if you get a GFR of 80, that is overestimating the person's true GFR, and it's not as accurate as we had hoped for. Presently, the most popular formula we use is something called the MDRD formula, derived from a study of modification of diet and renal disease. Basically, the MDRD study was a prospective observational study to see if decreased protein intake will halt the progression of renal disease. And from that study, we derive the MDRD formula. And it is a very complicated formula with exponentials, but it takes into account several variables. It takes into account serum creatinine, gender, race. There's the abbreviated MDRD formula, the four-variable MDRD formula. There's a six-variable MDRD formula and the seven-variable one. Our system, our computer system, MICES, uses the abbreviated MDRD. Sometimes you see in a comprehensive panel that the GFR is already calculated for you. They are using the abbreviated MDRD formula. This seems to be much better to true GFR. We feel, as nephrologists, we feel that this may underestimate true GFR. It seems like, you know, even normal-looking people are coming in with GFRs of 60. So it's really unclear where the truth is, but we're using this a lot in clinical studies and in our everyday conversations with other colleagues. This is also like an older gold standard, a 24-hour urine collection for creatinine. And basically, this formula, UV over P, urine creatinine concentration times urine flow rate over plasma creatinine times 0.7 if you're a woman, can also calculate the GFR, but something we don't do because we shy away from 24-hour collections in general due to the cumbersome nature of this task and inaccuracy. KDOQI has also come up with staging of CKD. Now we categorize the CKD according to these stages. Stage 1 is GFR greater than 90 and evidence of kidney damage. There were estimated 5.6 million people with stage 1 CKD. This is back in 2005. Stage 2 ranges from 60 to 89, 5.7 million. Stage 3, the most number, 30 to 59, 7.4 million. And this is very interesting. By the time you get to stage 4, GFR between 50 and 29, you've dropped off to 300,000. So what happened to all those people? You know, did they all die? That's a possibility. There are theories. Maybe they all died of cardiovascular deaths before they even get to stage 4 CKD. Or these patients just never progress to stage 4. They stay at stage 3. So that's another possibility. But it's an interesting observation. Stage 5 CKD, when your GFR is less than 15. And this is dialysis territory. You have to talk to your patient about renal replacement therapy. And unfortunately, this number is increasing every day. The natural history of renal disease. So the initial insult to the kidney may be varied from diabetes, hypertension, lupus, post-strep glomerular nephritis. However, if the insult does not go away, the secondary factors that cause progression are very similar. Basically, what happens is when you insult the kidney is that you're killing off nephrons. Nephrons, as you recall, is the functioning unit of each kidney. And if you deplete your kidneys of nephrons, you have less workhorses. And then the remaining workhorses will have to work extra hard. They start hyperfiltering, a process called adaptive hyperfiltration. And this is good in the short run. It preserves your GFR. So your creatinine looks like it's the same. It's working extra hard to get rid of that creatinine. But in the long run, there are damages, in particular from long-standing intraglomerular hypertension, causes inflammatory markers to be upregulated, cytokines that cause fibrosis, and essentially scarring in the end. Patients who suffer from who has adaptive hyperfiltration at the beginning end up with some degree of glomerulosclerosis towards the end. So long-term damage results in, it's clinically manifested by proteinuria, basically something wrong with the glomerular filtration process, and progressive renal insufficiency. This decline, fortunately or unfortunately, is generally asymptomatic if done slowly. And that's why oftentimes when a patient presents with CKD, especially in the clinic setting or even in the emergency room, it is a shock to both the patient and the physician. Like, how did this happen? Because it is mostly asymptomatic. There's no exact correlation between the level of BUN and the symptoms, but we do know that the higher the BUN, the more at risk you are to develop anorexia, nausea, vomiting, fatigue, all of which are uremic symptoms, non-specific uremic symptoms. How do you manage these patients? Well, first and foremost, you want to identify reversible causes. So even though we have a CKD patient, there may be a component of an acute kidney injury, acute on chronic disease. And the most common ones, especially for hospitalized patients, are decreased renal perfusion from volume depletion. They're not eating, drinking, they're vomiting, or they have diarrhea. They're on too much of a diuretic. So you want to identify that and take away that cause of volume depletion. Maybe there are on nephrotoxic drugs. A very common one is an NSAID, over-the-counter, something you really have to ask specifically for the patient because they don't consider that as a drug. NSAIDs inhibit your prostaglandin production, which inhibits vasodilatation and causes renal failure. So anybody with CKD, avoid NSAIDs. Urinary obstruction, not uncommon, especially in our diabetic population with neurogenic bladders, or our elderly male population with enlarged prostates. So always ask about that. So once you've reversed all identifiable causes, you try to prevent and slow progression, and we'll talk about how to do that. You treat the complications, you're probably very familiar with that, and then it is our duty, both as primary physicians and nephrologists, to identify as early as possible those who need to go on renal replacement therapy. What are factors that affect progression of CKD? These are unfortunately non-modifiable factors, but I'll just point them out. Age, if the patient, the older the patient, the more at risk they are to develop CKD. Remember, age is a factor in any of our formulas that we use. Gender, men tend to do worse than women. That's just a fact of life, unfortunately, for them. There was a time when we thought estrogen was protective in kidney progression, and there were a bunch of studies done to show that. So that may or may not be true, but it's very suggestive. Race. Kidney disease, any sort, seem to fare worse in African Americans, and that's a big chunk of our population, as well as Hispanics, but far more in African Americans. And genetics. We know that diabetes tend to run in families, and so do other nephropathies, like IgA nephropathy run in families. So there's a genetic component. Unfortunately, nothing we can do about right now. A lot of research on genetics of certain renal diseases, but it's all at a research level at this point. The modifiable risk factors where we come in. Protein. So our goal is to aim for the lower the protein, the better. Our guideline is less than 500 milligrams per 24 hours. None of us really collect 24-hour urines anymore, so a ratio of protein to creatinine ratio is just as good, less than 0.5 of that ratio. Hypertension. Our guideline is that anybody with CKD or diabetes, you want the blood pressure to be less than 130 over 80. There's no data to support this, but this is a guideline. And as far as we're concerned, CKD patients, the lower the blood pressure, the better. And generally, we treat them with an ACE and ARB for renal protection. Glycemic control. It's becoming more interesting as these multi-center randomized control studies are coming out. Back in 1993, from the landmark DCCT trial, which we oftentimes swear by, they had shown that if you have intensive glycemic control, you decrease your microvascular complications like nephropathies by 50%. And we all jumped on their wagon, strict glycemic control. And now all these studies are coming out, like the VADT study, the large VA study, showing that tight glycemic control shows no difference in microvascular complications. Certainly you want to know why there's such a stark difference. It may have something to do with their level of disease to begin with versus the end. The DCCT study was only in the type 1 diabetic population, and actually the rate of progression was very low in that study. So now we don't know what to do. Of course, you want them to have adequate glycemic control in general, but we're not going to tell them you have to have an A1C of less than 6 because there's no real data.
Sorry? The advanced study, mm-hmm. instead of the recent study, it's actually on cardiovascular. So kidney study, the quarter study didn't work on the tip kidney, but there's an advanced study from Australia that showed the 7 years, I don't know how many years,
So you're talking about the ACCORD study, which the microvascular complications data have not been released yet. They're still analyzing the data.
The advanced study, so
I was referring to the VADT study, which unfortunately did not show. They looked at kidney outcomes and did not show any improvement. Now the advanced study is showing us something else. Even, right? Macrovascular complications seems to be no difference and seems to have a slight benefit in kidney complications. So basically we've got all results, you know, better, no difference, worse. Core study showed worse macrovascular complications. So we don't know what to do with diabetes. We just say, you know, go to your primary care doctor, let them deal with it. But, you know, no strict guidelines in terms of that. Dyslipidemia, also no good data. Except to say that we're probably going to treat their lipid levels like we treat diabetics. We want their LDLs to be less than 100. But there seems to be a paradoxical effect of lipids that I'll go into a little later. Obesity, linked to higher rate of progression, CKD. We want them to lose weight for so many other reasons. And hyperuricemia, another marker that seems to be linked to the development of hypertension. A lot of research in this area. Hypertensive seem to have an increased uric acid level. Patients with CKD seem to have an increased uric acid level. So we want to treat this if they happen to be hyperuricemic. Treatment of the complications. You see these complications in the inpatient, the outpatient, and I'll go through each of those complications. Volume overload. Our bodies are able to respond to a volume load until our GFR decreases to dialysis territory between 10 and 15 ml per minute per 1.73 meter squared. However, once a patient achieves even mild to moderate CKD, they seem to have a less ability to respond to a volume load. So you want to be a little bit more ginger in giving them a volume load if you think that they need it. And how do you treat it? Well, you always advise on salt restriction and a diuretic therapy as mainstay. It takes care of volume and hypertension. Hyperkalemia, a very annoying complication because you're running after the patient, you know, running after the lab, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, in order to understand hyperkalemia, you have to understand the principal cell of the kidney. Where is this principal cell located in the kidney? You remember? So it's in the distal nephron, which means the second half of the nephron, but it's not in the distal tubule. It's in the collecting tubule. Okay, these words get... easily confused, and this is our collecting tubule cell. This is a principal cell. Beneath it is an intercalated cell. So whenever you have a patient with hyperkalemia, something usually is up with the cell. Something is not working 100%. As you may recall, potassium excretion happens here, a passive diffusion from the cell. But in order for potassium to come out, a sodium ion needs to come in, an even exchange of sodium for potassium. If you don't have sodium here, you're going to retain all your potassium intracellularly. And when do you not have sodium here? if the patient is dry, their volume depleted, all the sodium is reabsorbed proximally. You have decreased sodium delivery, and they become hyperkalemic. Similarly, if the patient is oliguric, no longer putting out urine, nothing to go, you know, no sodium to present itself at the distal nephron, so you're retaining all the potassium. What hormone acts on this cell? Aldosterone. Very good, very good. So aldosterone is very important because it keeps these channels open. Sodium, potassium, you keep them all open. It also pumps up this sodium, potassium, ATPase. So whenever you have aldosterone deficiency, and what instances might you have aldosterone deficiency?
Addison's,
you know, certainly. Not very common, but something you have to think about. But more commonly, iatrogenic reasons. You know, you give a patient an ACE inhibitor, they're going to have aldosterone insufficiency, and therefore they're hyperkalemic. And also, in our diabetics, why? RTA. Our diabetics tend to be hypoaldo, hyporenin. They get type 4 RTA. And therefore, whenever you have hyperkalemia, if you go through those two reasons, you've, you know, probably got the answer 90% of the time. Then you think about other, less common reasons if those two don't give you the answers. If the patient's on a high potassium diet, usually with this, because most of us, we probably all take high potassium diets, we don't become hyperkalemic because we have a functioning, hopefully we all have functioning kidneys with good urine flow, and we have good aldosterone levels. But if they're on a high K diet and they have something wrong with this and they become hyperkalemic, if they have increased tissue breakdown, muscle enzyme leakage, you may have hyperkalemia, and this we talked about. How do you treat these patients? You always advise them on a low-potassium diet. And low-potassium foods is not just avoiding bananas, which everyone knows, but also plantains, which is a cousin of the banana. Any tubers like potatoes, cassavas, tomatoes all have a lot of potassium. Prunes, artichokes, melons, cantaloupes, honeydew all have a lot of potassium. And milk has a good amount of potassium. So try to introduce those other ideas into people's heads because even we are oftentimes surprised how much potassium is in certain foods. And also give diuretics. Diuretics have the combined function of lowering your blood pressure, volume control, and lowering your potassium. And if necessary, K-exalate. Now, K-exalate may be used as a chronic treatment in somebody who's persistently hyperkalemic. You just give them 5 grams per meal, a very small dose. That's like a teaspoon. It's very well tolerated. So if you really can't control somebody, 5 grams per meal is okay. So something to think about. Another complication is metabolic acidosis. Why is metabolic acidosis bad? More specifically, it's not good for cellular health, certainly, if you have too much acid. But you could read here or shout out any. Why is it so bad? We're so scared of metabolic acidosis. Why is it bad? Maybe it's not bad. No, I mean, yeah, you get secondary respiratory alkalosis, but that's okay. right, which means that you can't keep up, so that means you're not going to be able to blow off the acid, which means that you become acidotic. But why is that bad? So our body, when our pH is low, we want to maintain our pH to a normal level. And in order to do that, when we have an acid load to our body, we want to buffer it. And where does most of our buffer come from?
Red cells?
Red cells could, but that doesn't make up the majority. Bicarb. It comes in the form of bicarb from the bones as calcium carbonate. That's the major organ to buffer an acid load in the body. And we're talking about chronic metabolic acidosis. Over time, when the bone gives up bicarb, it's also giving up calcium and phosphorus. So it's leaching calcium from the bones. It's giving you brittle bones. So long term, it's really bad for bone disease. Also, it turns out that uramic acidosis causes skeletal muscle breakdown. This may have something to do with the intracellular health, as you had mentioned, that you need to have a good pH to just maintain the health of a cell. It creates skeletal muscle breakdown, it diminishes albumin synthesis, so patients become very malnourished. They have a loss of lean body mass and decreased albumin, and they're very tired. So for those reasons, you want to treat the metabolic acidosis. And again, the guideline is that you should keep this bicarb, serum bicarb, above 22 milliequivalents per liter. The truth is we're not very aggressive about that. The interventional studies out there are not great to show clear benefit of treating with alkali therapy. But certainly if somebody gets to about 16 or 17 chronically and lower, we do want to treat them. And we treat them with sodium bicarbonate, which comes in tablets, or sodium citrate, which is a liquid. Sodium citrate you want to avoid in patients with liver disease because the liver converts citrate into bicarbonate. And also you want to avoid in patients taking aluminum, any sort of aluminum medicine, like aluminum hydroxide, because sodium citrate increases your reabsorption of aluminum. So that's metabolic acidosis. Secondary hyperparathyroidism. So just going to quickly review how this occurs. You have a normal kidney, you have renal failure, you have a shrunken kidney with decreased nephron mass. You have decreased number of nephrons. And therefore, you're not able to excrete your acid, as we talked about, but you're also not able to excrete the phosphorus that accumulates in the body. Remember, the kidney is responsible for phosphorus excretion, so results in hyperphosphatemia. Hyperphosphatemia appears to directly stimulate PTH production at the mRNA level. This is a parathyroid cell, so it goes straight there and revs up PTH production. On the other hand, hyperparathyroidism can confound hypocalcemia by binding to calcium and precipitate. You get calcifications in these patients. So it exacerbates hypocalcemia. Hypercalcemia also binds to the calcium sensing receptor on the PTH cell and revs up, stimulates PTH production. So for these reasons, you have increasing PTH. On the other hand, vitamin D. Now, some of you may have been at the lecture by Dr. Friedman last Friday about vitamin D production, how there are two forms of vitamin D. There's an active form, 125 vitamin D, with two hydroxyl groups, and one hydroxyl group, 25 vitamin D. 25 vitamin D is made in the liver and then brought to the kidney to be converted to 125 vitamin D, dihydroxy vitamin D, but it requires an enzyme that is located in the proximal tubule cells of the kidney. So as you have nephron dropout, you're going to have less amount of this enzyme. This enzyme is 1-alpha hydroxylase. And therefore, you have less 125-dihydroxy vitamin D. Vitamin D deficiency also affects PTH production. There seems to be a vitamin D receptor on the PTH cell. And so a decreased amount will increase these levels. So three factors, high phosphorus, low calcium, low vitamin D, causes secondary hyperparathyroidism. And we'll talk about why secondary hyperparathyroidism is bad. So how do you treat that? We've identified three factors, so we want to treat those three factors. Phosphorus binders. I think most of you are familiar. We first advocate a low phosphorus diet because most of phosphorus comes in our diet, and it's hard to control just with medications. You want to advise less than 800 milligrams per day. Foods that have a lot of phosphorus, any dairy products, ice cream, milk, have a lot of phosphorus, chocolate. So keep those in mind. Anything that has preservatives, like instant coffees, pancake mixes, have a lot of phosphorus. There are a few types of phosphorus binders. There are the calcium-based phosphorus binders and the non-calcium-based phosphorus binders. These are cheaper, and these are good for those patients who also happen to be hypocalcemic, which may be the case in patients that you've identified early. They're hypocalcemic, which actually we didn't talk about. They're hypocalcemic because their vitamin D levels are low, and vitamin D helps to facilitate calcium reabsorption in the gut. So you'd want to give patients calcium-based binders if they happen to be hypocalcemic, but if they're not hypocalcemic, it's better to give them non-calcium binders to avoid calcification deposition in the tissues in the future. The non-reabsorbable agents, most of you are familiar with sevelamer or Renagel. A newer form of sevelamer called Renvela, this is supposed to give you less acidosis. Renagel can give you some degree of acidosis. Lanthanum or fosrenone is another non-calcium-based agent that we don't have on the formulary, but it is used in the outpatient setting. Aluminum binders, aluminum hydroxide, was a mainstay for decades. Very powerful, very effective. Unfortunately, it also caused dementia and a dynamic bone disease and osteomalacia, and therefore frowned upon. But in the acute setting, you could use it for a few weeks at a time. We tend to use it, especially in our ICU patients, when their phosphoruses are very high. This will do the trick.
Is there any difference for Renagel and fosrenone, those kind of binders?
Yeah, they're both what's known as non-absorbable binders. Their molecular composition is different, but their idea is that they will trap the phosphorus in your gut, and you just excrete it through the stool.
Was on both of them. Is that
reasonable? I'm sorry?
I had a patient
who was on both.
Yeah,
we do that. We phosphorus control, and I assume this is a dialysis patient, right?
Yeah.
Phosphorus control is very difficult to achieve in dialysis patients, and so you try all things. In order for phosphorus control, a patient may need to take up to 5 Renagels per meal. And these are, you know, not small tablets, and they feel very bloated. And so to help with control, we limit, you know, maybe 3 Renagels and 1 fosrenol. So we're just playing with what they can tolerate. Next, we want to supplement them with vitamin D, the active type, which is by prescription only, again, to decrease the PTH level. And there are 3 types, only 1 on formulary, calcitriol or rocaltrol, paracalcitol, another name is Zemplar, and doxycalciferol, hectorol. These 2 tend to have a less hypercalcemic effect. Calcitriol has will also raise your calcium. So in patients with already high calciums or calcifications, you really want to avoid. And finally, the newest thing is a calcium mimetic, which calcium mimetic means that it pretends to be calcium, and it will sit on the calcium sensing receptor on the PTH cell and fool the PTH cell, thinking that there's enough calcium around so they can tone down their PTH production. The trade name is Sensipar. Sort of expensive, you know. You could get at Jacobi, but not without a fight. But we give it to patients when their PTH is really out of control, you know, usually in the 700-800s. Unfortunately, this happened. Renal osteodystrophy. So the reason we are so concerned about secondary hyperparathyroidism is that it causes a whole slew of renal bone disease. And this is a simplified slide on the types of bone disease, osteitis fibrosa, osteomalacia, and adynamic bone disease. Osteitis fibrosa is what's known as a high turnover bone disease. These patients tend to have high PTHs. Their bones are just, calcium is coming out. There's a lot of osteoclastic activity. The bones are very weak and unhealthy. Osteomalacia and adynamic bone disease are low turnover bone disease. Osteomalacia used to occur a lot because of aluminum deposition. You basically have no bone there. Adynamic bone disease is happening more and more now from over-suppression of PTH. If we treat the PTH to very low levels, then you're suppressing their function, and it results in weak, unmineralized adynamic bone disease. So these are our target values according to guidelines. When the patient is stage 3, you want to aim their PTH between 35 and 70. Notice this is already above normal levels of PTH for a normal person, because we don't want to over-suppress their PTH. For stage 4, you want their PTH between 70 and 110. Stage 5, between 150 and 300. These values are usually followed by the nephrologist, so you don't have to be too concerned about the details. Just a picture of what can happen if the calcium phosphorus gets out of control. You can have metastatic calcification, and here you basically see these phalanges as a rock, just a lot of calcification. Hypertension, mostly related to volume, and you want to treat them with ACE and ARB and a diuretic. A diuretic to treat the volume, ACE and ARB to limit any proteinuria that can occur. Thiazides become ineffective when GFR falls below 20, so you really have to switch them over to Lasix. And if you want to use Lasix as an antihypertensive, you should give it to them twice a day because it's so short-lasting. But if you just want to take care of that bit of edema, once a day is fine. The goal, again, is BP of less than 130 over 80, but even a lower goal should be pursued if they have a lot of protein in the urine, their urine protein creatinine ratio is more than 1.
With ACE inhibitors, I know we're limited at a certain point because of the risk of hyperkalemia. What is the level of creatinine that we should be concerned of to stop ACE inhibitors?
Yeah, so that level gets higher and higher. The threshold for concern gets higher and higher. Before, I think when I was in training, they said 25%. Now they say 35%. So you see a decrease in GFR by 35%, more than that, then you should back down.
I had read somewhere creatinine of 2.5. Is that
normal? There's no specific number. You know, 2.5 means so differently to...
Yeah, exactly.
A different person.
Yes, sir.
So we think about change in GFR, and if the change is less than 35%, it's acceptable. If it's more than 35%, then you've got to back down a little bit. But make sure it should plateau. If it continues to go down, then you have to see what else is happening. Any other questions up to now? There's a lot of information in a short period of time.
Do you rather have the albumin creatinine ratio or the protein?
That's a very good question. That's, we usually just follow the protein-creatinine ratio. If the protein is very little, if it's less than 1, then albumin becomes more useful. But if you already have a nephrotic patient, 2 or 3 grams of protein, you check their albumin, it's going to be in the thousands. Like, what do you do with that number? But if it's less than 1, then albumin ratio might give you more. The most important thing is to follow that number and see where it goes as opposed to an absolute number. Some people will say, well, for diabetics, you should do albumin to creatinine. For everybody else, you can do protein to creatinine. We tend to be more with protein to creatinine in our renal clinic. So there's no specific guideline for that, per se. Anemia, another complication of CKD. The primary cause for anemia in most CKD patients is erythropoietin deficiency. Erythropoietin is made in the kidney, so more nephron dropout, less EPO, they become deficient. Keep in mind, EPO deficiency in anemia is a normal chromic normocytic anemia, which means they're not iron deficient. So if a patient, other causes of anemia in CKD may very well be iron deficiency anemia or secondary hyperparathyroidism, et cetera, if you find a patient who is iron deficient, which actually happens to be like 90% of our CKD patients, you have to find out why. Is the patient menstruating? Has the patient had a colonoscopy? All the usual, you know, take CKD out of the picture and work up the iron deficiency. It cannot be attributed to CKD. CKD should not cause iron deficiency. And secondary hyperparathyroidism, EPO seems to respond less well when a patient's PTH is very high. Folate deficiency may happen from a poor nutritional status. So our guidelines, as far as we know from recent clinical trials, we want the target hemoglobin to be between 11 and 12. There was evidence that hemoglobins greater than 12 caused an increase in mortality, which was completely counter to what we had assumed. Retrospective studies years before showed improvement in cardiovascular outcomes, mortality, when you increase the hemoglobin. But now, in these prospective interventional studies, showed otherwise. So it took us all by surprise. And we're not going to over-treat them. We just want their hemoglobin to be between 11 and 12. And we want to work up anemia in patients when their hemoglobin is less than 11 in premenopausal females and prepubertal patients, less than 12 in adult males and postmenopausal females. And you treat them by giving them erythropoietin stimulating agents such as Epogen, another name is Procrit. They're the same agent, just by different companies. And Aranesp, which is darbepoietin, it's supposed to have a longer half-life than EPO, and that's why it may be good for patients. The efficacy seems to be similar in all these categories. So usually the nephrologist deals with dosing, et cetera, so I won't go into that. Dyslipidemia, we mentioned a little bit about it. The primary finding in CKD patients is hypertriglyceridemia, not necessarily high LDL. But if the LDL is high, you probably want it to be less than 100. But there's not much evidence. And in fact, there was a large study in stage 5 patients that showed a negative association between low cholesterol levels and mortality, i.e., you know, the lower the cholesterol level, the worse the patient did. So we don't really know what to do.
Does it have to do with liver disease? Sometimes severe liver disease
can cause... Yeah, sure. You want to think about confounding factors, but it seems to be more related to nutritional status, that most of these patients were actually malnourished. It's like AIDS patients. If their cholesterol level is very low, they're not going to do very well. Preparation for renal replacement therapy. So you definitely want to refer the patient to nephrology when the GFR falls below 60. In our clinic, we have a nurse educator. We talk to them, explain to them what CKD is all about because it's not the most publicized entity out there. And we also introduce the types of renal replacement therapy in center hemodialysis, which probably accounts for over 90% of dialysis patients. They go to a dialysis center. Peritoneal dialysis, something that you can do at home. We're trying to promote that as well because it can be very good for a lot of people, especially for professionals. And home hemodialysis, gaining traction. These patients actually cannulate themselves at home. And they either sleep while they're being dialyzed or they do cannulate themselves for 2 hours every day. So that's becoming more popular. Obviously, you have to select the right patient for that. Access placement. Once you've identified a patient for CKD, for dialysis of any sort, you have to refer them to the right surgeon. Hemodialysis needs a vascular surgeon. A peritoneal dialysis usually needs a general surgeon for PD catheter replacement. And once you think the patient needs hemodialysis, you want to save the non-dominant arm. So, you know, most of us are right-handed. You want to save the left arm from venipunctures and heplocks to preserve the veins on that arm. So something that we can all work on. So I guess I'm going to whiz through dialysis in 5 minutes. Any questions up to now?
When you start with one patient that are not iron deficient, would you still give them iron to kind of curb on erythropoietin?
Very good question. What do people think? Have you ever seen patients on iron and EPO at the same time? All the time, because EPO still needs a substrate of iron to make for the bone marrow to work. So one of the things that you want to rule out before starting somebody on EPO is to check their iron studies and replete them with iron. Make sure their iron levels are adequate before you even start them with EPO. The number we use is a TSAT, iron TSAT of at least 15%. Some people say 20%. And if you ever have the fun of filling out these insurance forms for prior authorization for EPO, they ask you what is the iron level. They want to make sure you're not going to just like throw expensive drug, you know, without the substrate. So you need both.
But if it's normal level,
then it's fine. Yeah, 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 it's fine. So dialysis. maybe I'll just talk about the real, you know, the things that affect you. Indications for dialysis. Indications to start dialysis in chronic patients are less clear, you know, because you want them to feel better, quality of life, etc. Indications for acute dialysis are much more stark and easy to understand. And a nice mnemonic is AEIOU. A for intractable acidosis. E for electrolyte imbalances like potassium and bicarb. I for intoxication like alcohol, methanol, ethylene glycol. O for volume overload. And U for uremic symptoms. So there's no exact number, no BUN and creatinine attached to it, but you take the whole picture. The only numbers attached to it are potassium and pH. How does dialysis occur? Well, basically, it's all about diffusion. Something you learn in high school chemistry, you have molecules in two compartments. Over time, if this membrane is permeable, the concentration gradients equalize after time. So that's exactly what happens in dialysis. We have a semi-permeable membrane. This is the blood of the patient. This is the dialysis fluid. Patients have a lot of BUN and creatinine. It will go down its concentration gradient to dialysis fluid, which has none. So that's how it gets rid of it. Patient may not have enough bicarb. It takes it from the dialysis fluid. Dialysis fluid happens to have a lot of bicarb, goes into the patient. Sodium tends to be isotonic in the dialysis fluid. Potassium tends to be very low. We can dial anywhere from 0K to 4K, depending on the potassium level of the patient. So it goes down its concentration gradient. Here it just shows that the direction of flow of blood is opposite to direction of flow of dialysate fluid to maximize the concentration gradient at any given point. These are the contents of a typical dialysis solution. We had mentioned sodium. Potassium depends on how hyperkalemic the patient is. A little bit of calcium, usually no glucose, and bicarb is usually, it's an alkalinic bag of electrolytes as compared to the patient. Our renal patients are usually acidemic. Ultrafiltration. You may hear this term used by nephrologists, and ultrafiltration refers to removal of fluid only. It doesn't have anything to do with solute clearance, and this comes into play when patients are volume expanded, in CHL, pulmonary edema. You want to remove 2 to 3 kilos, and basically we can punch into the dialysis machine, say we want to remove 3 kilos. And the machine is applying a pressure and basically squeezing fluid out of the patient's blood into the waste. And that's ultrafiltration. Peritoneal dialysis uses the concept of diffusion, except it's using the patient's peritoneal membrane as a dialysis membrane. The blood compartment are the peritoneal capillaries, and the dialysate solution is drained into the patient through a PD catheter. Exchange happens. The fluid sits in the patient's belly. Diffusion happens. It dwells for a few hours, and then the waste product will then drain into a waste bag. So this is peritoneal dialysis that patients can do at home. And CRRT. So I'm talking about some inpatient material here because I don't think you'll have an opportunity later on to hear about dialysis, but CRRT stands for continuous renal replacement therapy, and it's only done in the ICU because it is targeting the unstable, hemodynamically unstable patients who does not tolerate normal dialysis. Because CRRT provides a slower rate of solute and fluid removal per unit of time, the blood flow rate is also very slow. And it's for the patient who's on pressor, who's very unstable. And when you need this, you call the renal fellow. Unfortunately, it hasn't shown any improvement in outcome, but we provide it because the patient doesn't have a choice. Complications of hemodialysis. You see this all the time. Patients get admitted from these complications. The most common ones are hypotension during dialysis, infection, and catheter dysfunction. Why do patients become hypotensive? Well, it could be that you're just removing too much fluid and therefore it drops your blood pressure. But the truth is, if we get 3 liters taken out from us, chances are we'll be okay because we have a good heart. We can increase our contractility, our ejection fraction. But in somebody with CAD, they don't have that ability. And therefore, when their blood pressure drops during dialysis, one of the first things you want to consider is some degree of coronary artery disease. Autonomic neuropathy is a problem, especially in our diabetic population, where their blood pressure just plummets from 200 to below 100 in the span of 2 hours. And that's something very difficult for all of us to manage because we want to remove fluid, but when their blood pressure drops, we're limited. So we try little tricks, but it is a limiting problem with autonomic neuropathy. And the question about antihypertensive medications, every patient's a little different. Some patients get hypertensive on dialysis, so they need their AM meds even though they're going to dialysis, and some patients cannot tolerate it. So the only way to know is see how the patient behaves, and then you'll get a sense whether the patient should be medicated before dialysis or not. Hypotension, we sort of mentioned, from diastolic dysfunction, from LVH, ischemic heart disease, and they cannot afford to have so much fluid removed in such a short period of time. Catheter infections. By far the most common organism that's affected are staph species, MSSA or MRSA. Oftentimes, when they show up in the ER, they're febrile, they've got a catheter, it's a catheter infection to prove an otherwise. We empirically treat them for MRSA. And the agents we give are Vanc and Gent. Gent does the double duty of covering gram-negative organisms and synergism for MRSA with Vanc. Now, there are a few ways of approaching this. If there's just a local infection with no tunnel affecting, then you treat them for 2 weeks. If there's a tunnel infection, if you press on the length of the catheter and it's tender or red, then you have to treat them for at least 3 weeks, and preferably you remove the catheter, you exchange it for a new one. If there's any evidence of systemic infection, like hypotension, you've got to remove the catheter, you dialyze them through a temporary catheter, and then you can put a new one in. Now, antibiotic use, need to stress this. Patients who eventually grow out MSSA, and your cultures come back eventually, switch them to Nefsilin, please. Don't keep them on Vanc. Don't think, well, they're leaving, so Vanc is better for them. It's more convenient as an outpatient. We have cefazolin at the outpatient, which is even more sensitive than Vanc to MSSA. With this increasing incidence of VREs, visas, none of us want to be practicing medicine when visas rampant. You know, it's a little scary to bring those organisms home to our children. So we want to preserve Vanc. And I realize that nephrologists are main culprits of using Vanc all the time. And I've spoken to my colleagues as well as the ID service of sticking to Nefsilin unless it's MRSA. Nefsilin is so much better in terms of sensitivity. And if you don't treat the infection, these are the bad complications that, unfortunately, you'll never be able to get rid of. Endocarditis, very difficult to treat. Osteomyelitis, thrombophlebitis, and epidural abscesses. You don't want to get there. Catheter dysfunction. If the catheter doesn't work immediately after placement, you have to think about malpositioning. It's generally not because of a thrombus. It's so new. Get an x-ray, speak with interventional radiology. Chances are they'll have to pull it out and put a new one in. However, if it's after 5 days, do you think about a thrombus? We give them TPA and see if it works. Ultimately, they all need new catheters. And finally, the three types of vascular access. Permanent catheter, we don't like to call it permanent because they really shouldn't be walking around with catheters. They get infected all the time. They don't give good clearances, so we frown upon that. AV graft is a synthetic cortex piece of tubing that connects a patient's artery to a vein. This is the tubing. We also don't like that because it is synthetic. It is prone to thrombosis and maybe infection. Not as bad as the catheter.